You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to the creator of a history project to discover stories of past and present Indigenous UW students, employees, and faculty. Now, NASA is set to launch the James Webb Space Telescope on Christmas morning after decades of development and years of being pushed back. Scientists say the $10 billion telescope could help them see the origins of the solar system and try to detect life on other planets. Learning more now about how the technology works and why the scientific community is excited and nervous about its launch. Andrew Nine is a graduate student in the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Department of Astronomy studying binary stars. His research will use the James Webb Space Telescope if it works as intended. Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Why are scientists like you so excited about this new telescope?
Well, put short, it is an absolute game changer in astronomy. This is very much the successor telescope to the Hubble Space Telescope, which has produced truly top quality science for at least the past 30 years.
And I've heard people talk about Hubble as like there was astronomy before Hubble, and then there's astronomy after Hubble. It's like a dividing point. Do you think it could be the same with the Webb Telescope?
For sure. Yes, absolutely.
So what is it doing? What can it do? What are its capabilities that are going to be such game changers?
Yeah, so the real special point about James Webb is that it is specialized to look at infrared light. And the reason that is special is it will allow us to see further back in space and in time than ever before. And it will also allow us to study exoplanets in even greater detail.
Now, this is a lot of billions of dollars put into it, a lot of years mm-hmm. put into it. I imagine a lot of people are going to be biting their nails when the launch time comes. Are you going to be watching in real time, or are you just going to go away for a while and hope for the best?
Seeing as it's going to launch early in the morning, I'm going to be in the camp of I will wake up and hope to God.
Yeah. Talk about the complexity of, first of all, this incredibly delicate instrument and the challenges of getting it from Earth into orbit.
Yeah. So, as of right now, the major limiting factor is the weather in French Guiana. So unfortunately, we are currently in the rainy season in Kourou, where the telescope will be launched. So as of right now, the delays that we're experiencing are weather related. Of course, you can't launch a rocket in lightning or in high winds. And then once you get into space, that's by no means the end of the journey. There are over 300 single points of failure on James Webb, which means there are more than 300 components or processes that if any one of them were to fail, the whole mission is gone.
Talking to Andrew Nine from the UW Astronomy Department, looking at the likely launch now on Saturday of the new James Webb Orbital Telescope, what it could mean for science. Andrew, we know this thing will help us see a long way away. And one of the weird things about space is that helps us see into the past. Can you tell us in a way that I can understand why we get to look into the past when we look a long way away?
Yes. So the reason we look into the past when we look into deep space is because light travels at a finite speed. So because it takes light some amount of time to get from the source that emits it, whether it's a star or a galaxy, to here on Earth, because that light travels at some speed, we're seeing that object not as it is right now, but as it was when it sent off that light in the first place. So when we say something is 1 billion light years away, what we're really saying is we are seeing the light now that it emitted 1 billion years ago.
You study binary stars. First of all, give us a binary star 101. How common are they? What are they?
Yes. So a binary star is two stars that orbit one another. They formed at the same time from the same material. So they're identical in composition and they orbit each other for their lifetimes. As for their frequency, there's an old joke that gets passed around in astronomy that goes that three out of every two stars are binaries. Yeah, so for stars like our sun, it turns out that about half of stars like our sun are in binary. So where we see what we think is one star, there are actually two. For lower mass stars, about a tenth of a solar mass or so, their binary frequency is more like 10 or 20%. And for the very highest mass stars, once you get past, 10 solar masses or so, all of them are in binaries, as far as we can tell.
So with Webb in place, what are you hoping to learn about binary stars in particular?
Yes, so I work on a particular kind of binary star called a blue straggler. So these are binary stars that are particularly close together, and one star is a little bit more massive than the other, and the star that's more massive will evolve first and expand. And if it's close enough to its companion, the outer layers of that evolved star will get ripped off and dumped onto the companion. So what you end up with is a star that is way bluer, way hotter than it should be given its age, and you'll have a white dwarf that was the core of the former evolved star orbiting it. Now, what we don't know about this process, and what I hope that James Webb will tell us eventually, is whether or not any mass is lost from the system entirely. That's still one of the great big open questions about this process. So what I'm hoping to see is there material that is leaving this system that has cooled off and is now emitting in the infrared?
Okay, if I'm an astronomer and I want to get some screen time on the Webb telescope, mm-hmm. I imagine there's a pretty long line. How does that work?
Yes, so in order to get time on the James Webb Space Telescope or on any telescope, you have to submit what is called a proposal. And this is essentially a document that proves you know what the telescope is capable of and you are going to make good use of this time. And of course, there is indeed, as you say, a very long line to use James Webb Space Telescope. There's only so much time available for observing, and the current proposals right now are accounting for approximately 10 times what James Webb is available to give.
So do you have a thought, like if it goes up, how long will it be? Can you get him to point it at some of your favorite binary stars?
I sure hope so, but that is many years down the line for me.
Well, I guess the good news is this is going to free up all kinds of time on the Hubble, right?
Yes. Now, they're going to be answering different kinds of questions, but yeah, hopefully it does free up some time on Hubble as well.
So apart from binary star questions, mm-hmm. what are some of the other things that you're hoping with the Webb telescope in place, the big questions in astronomy that this is going to help us answer?
Yes, so this is going to be the best instrument we have to determine whether or not we are truly alone in the universe. So one of the weird things that James Webb Space Telescope would likely be able to detect is plant life. So it turns
plant
out
life.
That, yes. Now, we're not going to resolve any exo-Amazon, as cool as that would be, but it turns out that chlorophyll, the compound that makes plants green and allows them to convert carbon dioxide to oxygen, also reflects really strongly in the infrared. So if we're looking at an exoplanet in the infrared and we see way more infrared light than we should for this exoplanet, that might be an indication there are plants on that planet that use chlorophyll.
That's exciting. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Andrew Nine is a graduate student researching binary stars at the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy. He's with us today previewing the upcoming launch of the James Webb Space Telescope. Latest bump back to Saturday morning. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about how watching your parents dance as a child shapes the legacy you leave behind with your own children.
Have you ever been at a wedding and caught a glimpse of your parents slow dancing? Maybe you marveled, or maybe you cringed, but I'm willing to bet you felt something. Jan Larson shares a story about how watching her parents dance in the kitchen brought her comfort as a child, and now as a mother as she watches her children forge their own affections.
The legacy parents leave their children isn't always easy to spot. On those rare occasions when we get a glimpse of something good, it is oh so sweet. As a child, I delighted in my father's nightly ritual. He would sneak up on my mother as they cleared away the dinner table or wiped down the countertops, and what was our kitchen transformed into their private ballroom dance floor. I only have eyes for you. He crooned tenderly as he wrapped his arms around her, his face nestled into that space along the back of her neck and shoulder. Gently, he twirled her around, ignoring her mock protests, and swept her into his arms in a glide across the linoleum floor. The moment was brief, enchanting, and one that left a young child certain of her parents' love. All was right with the world. Some years later, I met and married my own darling. And then, one night while tidying the kitchen, I felt his arms wrap around me, hands turning me to face him as he guided me in our own dance across the hardwood floor. Happy tears pricked at my eyes as he twirled me, pulled me close, and then finished with the big dip. As toddlers, our children squealed with pleasure at Daddy's strength and the light in Mom's eyes. As teens, they offered eye rolls, shoulder shrugs, and the predictable, "Get a room," to which we replied, "We have a license, marriage that is, to do this." But underneath the playful teasing, our children too were certain of their parents' love. And again, all was right with the world. Not too long ago, our eldest son stopped in for a Saturday brunch. As logs crackled in the fireplace and music filled our home, I busied myself in the kitchen. The little boy who once reached up to me, now a young man, put his hands on my shoulders and turned me to face him, pulling me toward him for his own dance. As we swayed to the music, he looked down. "I want to be like you," he said. Stunned, my response was brutally honest. "Why?" He tossed his head back in a brief laugh. "Just do." All my mistakes, all my flaws flashed through my mind. This would not do. I did not want to waste the moment. But what to say? "Take the good, but leave the rest," I fairly pleaded. Another light laugh. "Okay, Mom." I realize now I don't need to fear for my son. He knows my flaws, yet finds reason to love. Perhaps in following his father's example, taking our dance and making it his own, he already has claimed the best we have to offer. If the legacy of children being certain of love is what we leave behind, then sweet is the knowledge that all will be right with the world.
Jan Larson is a journalist and professor at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, we learn about an effort to collect Native voices and stories to tell a part of the missing history at UW-Madison. That's up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new project at UW-Madison aims to fill in missing stories of Indigenous students and others who are part of the past and present of the campus community. Storytelling is central for our next guest and her family. That tradition is part of what inspired her to seek out unrecorded stories of Native people who've worked for or attended UW. Zeta Ballou is a graduate student at UW-Madison in the History Department and a researcher for the university's Public History Project. Zeta, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Miigwech, Rob. Thank you so much for having me.
Can you share some of your own experience with storytelling and in your family? You wrote about that some in an online post for the Public History Project.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am an enrolled citizen of the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi Indians on my dad's side. And one of my fondest memories growing up as part of this tribal nation is anytime there was a family gathering in my grandmother's house, my dad, my sister, his 11 brothers and siblings would pack into my grandma's house, which in hindsight could probably only comfortably hold less than half of us, but we made it work. And immediately as we got there, we would begin doing what we do best, which is telling and sharing stories, some that we've heard before, many that we haven't. But I brought that love of storytelling and listening with me to graduate school at UW-Madison.
And then you got linked up with this Public History Project. What attracted you to this?
Yeah, so I was hired in the spring of 2021 by the UW-Madison Public History Project, which is a multi-year effort to uncover and give voice to those who experienced, challenged, and overcame prejudice on campus. The goal of the project is to ensure that all students and alumni are aware of the full history of the university, including the accomplishments of campus community members from marginalized populations whose stories previously may have been hidden or not as widely known. So I was hired this past spring to research the Native history of UW-Madison from its founding in 1848 up into the present. As someone who is a Native student at UW herself, myself, I jumped at the opportunity to learn about this history of the university and its Native stories and students on campus.
So you started to hit the archives, and what did you find? And I guess maybe more importantly, what didn't you find?
Yeah, so I started where document-based historians usually start, with the documents. And I went to the Wisconsin Historical Society. I went to the UW Archives. And to my great surprise, I could not find Native stories or voices represented in our documents or in our archives more broadly.
Does that mean they weren't there, or that people didn't record those stories?
So I'm leaning more towards the fact that people didn't record those histories, because we know that UW-Madison mm-hmm. occupies Ho-Chunk land. We know that Native people have been here since long before the university and have continued to be here since. And I think that the silences in our archives, as they revolve around Native voices, is mostly because perhaps the information that gets stored in our archives most often reflects the values of the communities who have contributed to these archives. So since there are so few Native voices and stories in those archives, it sends us a message that, at least in the past, the history of UW's Native students was not as significant as non-Native UW students, alumni, faculty, and staff's histories, or those who have been more fully preserved in our archives.
Talking to Zeta Ballou, graduate student at the UW-Madison History Department, researcher for the university's Public History Project. Zeta, you found that archival absence, and you set out to fix it. What did you do?
Yes, so I went to Native students, faculty, and alumni who I knew, and I started asking the questions, the types of questions that I wish the sources in our archives would have been asking all along. And so I changed my approach completely to this work. I set out to see if those Native students, those activists who had profoundly changed the university, would be willing to share those stories with us. And much to my surprise and pleasure, several of them have since.
What are some of the kinds of stories you're hearing?
Oh gosh, I've met an activist, a revolutionary really, from the 1970s who organized as part of the American Indian Movement and who organized on campus to protest the unjust treatment of Indigenous, Black, and Hispanic students, as well as the Vietnam War during the 1970s. I also met an individual by the name of Kelly Holmes, who during her time as co-president of Wang Sheik, was one of the first on campus to adopt a land acknowledgement, or a recognition that their gatherings were taking place on Ho-Chunk land before the widespread acknowledgement or implementation of land acknowledgements across the campus. Those are just two of the several incredible Native people who I've met and I continue to meet each and every day that I'm a part of this project.
And are you finding, as you talk to this person, they're saying, oh, and you also ought to talk to blank and blank?
Yes, as soon as I get in touch with one, they introduce me to, I literally have a list of hundreds of Native people who have attended UW and have profoundly shaped this university's history, none of whom I found documented in our archives prior to doing the work of oral history.
Is it weird for people to talk about themselves as being a part of history, if that makes sense? Like, yeah, this is just our daily lives. I don't think we often think of ourselves as being historically significant.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I approach Native folks to do this work, most of the time they're very surprised that anything that they would have to say or the histories that they have about this university would be of any historic value. But in fact, what this project teaches us, not only Native people who have been to UW, but non-Native community members as well, is that anyone, especially Native people at UW, can in fact make history. But this will only happen if their stories are told and preserved for future generations to listen to and learn from.
Yeah, can you talk about the value of oral history in general and any topic, the importance of hearing those stories and like you said, preserving them?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the best parts about oral history is that with the collection of these stories, you can now, anyone in the UW community can go to the UW archives, ask to hear a story from Kelly Holmes or other Native students who have gone before here. And you can put on a set of headphones or read the transcript and hear Native people tell stories of this place in their own words and on their own terms. It's absolutely powerful. I highly encourage anyone out there to go into the archives and look for these stories themselves, because you'll learn a significant amount of the past that we don't have documented in our archives besides these oral histories.
This is a UW-Madison specific project, Zeta, but if somebody's listening and saying, we need to do this in my campus or school or community or whatever institution, what would you mm-hmm. recommend them to get it started?
Yeah, so I would recommend, number one, starting relationships with the people whose histories you want to have preserved. And with the UW-Madison Public History Project, we have a subscription to a platform called Their Story. It's like Zoom, but it's entirely set up for oral history. So I highly recommend working with that platform because it's been incredibly valuable to us.
What are you looking forward to now? I mean, you've been collecting stories already. What are your plans for the future now on this project?
I would love to collect as many stories as we can. Of course, these things take time and effort and energy. But for those out there listening who want to learn more about these efforts, we are currently, we have a website called the UW-Madison Public History Projects. If you out there think that you have a story of UW-Madison worth sharing, we are absolutely willing to listen. Reach out to us via our website. And then the next step for the project overall is that in the fall of 2022, there's going to be two exhibits for the UW-Madison and Greater Madison community. There's going to be a physical exhibit housed at the Chazen Museum of Art. That's in the fall of 2022. There you can learn more about the histories of not only Native folks on campus, but other BIPOC students who organized on campus and shaped our community's history. If you can't make it to the physical exhibit, don't worry. We also have a digital exhibit coming up that will be preparing in the fall of 2022 that will be housed on our website.
Zeta, thanks again for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's UW history grad student Zeta Ballou. She talked with us about her work tracking down and recording stories of Native and Indigenous UW students, staff, and faculty as part of the university's Public History Project. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, most road crashes are blamed on human error. But a traffic expert says we could change our roads and our systems to prevent a lot of the worst collisions. And from farms to food companies, there's a lot of consolidation in American agriculture. Is bigger, better? That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then President Biden says he's still hopeful to reach a deal with Senator Joe Manchin on his Build Back Better legislation or something like it. We'll get the latest during our look at the week in Washington. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, what you need to know about Omicron and how to stay safe. First, President Biden addressed the nation yesterday to talk about steps he's taking to respond to a rise in COVID-19 cases, driven in part by the Omicron variant, now the most common strain of the virus in the U.S. It's the week in Washington. We're looking at the week's top stories in national politics, including yesterday's speech from the White House. Biden reassured vaccinated Americans about their level of safety and outlined the risks for those who haven't gotten their initial vaccinations and booster shots. He also announced that 500 million at-home test kits will be available for free starting in January. And teams of military medical personnel are being dispatched to reinforce hospitals in six states. One of those is Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What was your reaction to the president's speech yesterday? If you watched or listened to it, what do you think of the new steps he announced, his approach to the pandemic in general? What questions were you left with? What would you like to see, if anything, from the federal government on coronavirus response that isn't happening right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Francesca Chambers is a White House correspondent for McClatchy. Francesca, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
What kind of tone were we hearing from the president in this address yesterday?
Well, the president wanted Americans to know that he understands that they're tired and that they want this pandemic to be over, but realistically, it's just not. And he said that it was frustrating for everyone, and he understands that, and tried to reassure them that the federal government is working hard to combat the current wave of COVID and its surging resources around the country.
There's a lot of focus on the vaccine in his speech, and he did something during a speech yesterday he hasn't done much, bringing up former President Trump. He mentioned that Trump had gotten his booster shot and gave some credit to the previous administration. Here's a listen.
Let me be clear. Thanks to the prior administration and our scientific community, America is one of the first countries to get the vaccine. Thanks to my administration and the hard work of Americans, we led a rollout, made America among the world leaders in getting shots in arms.
So Biden mentioned Trump by name and getting the booster shot, referenced the prior administration. I think a lot of times the references have been along lines of, I'm not keeping track of the former guy. What did you make of that inclusion of the previous administration in this speech?
The White House has acknowledged that it's struggled to reach out to supporters of former President Donald Trump and get them vaccinated. And so it seems now that they've shifted their approach on this message to give credit to the former president who was in office when the vaccine was developed and try to use that as a tool to get unvaccinated Americans who may support him to get vaccinated and also to get boosted as it faces this wave from the new variant.
I mentioned a couple of the practical measures we heard from the president, including issues of hospital capacity and staffing. What kind of things do we hear about that and what the White House is doing to at least try to alleviate that?
The biggest message from the White House now is that Americans who were vaccinated need to get boosted and that the best way to keep hospitals clear is if Americans are boosted. The message from the president that we heard yesterday is that Americans who are vaccinated and have the booster could still become sick, but they're significantly less likely to face both hospitalization or death if they have the booster.
And then we heard this idea of getting at-home rapid testing to people. We had heard Jen Psaki, the spokesperson for the administration, joking about the idea a while back of, what do you want us to do, send test kits to every American? It sounds like the president is talking about doing something along those lines.
And Jen Psaki has said since then that it was an inartful comment and that we all wish that we had phrased things differently, acknowledging that, because the White House is now setting up a website that it says will be live in January, in which Americans will be able to apply for COVID tests that they can have sent to them. The White House says that it's ordering 500 million rapid tests for Americans to be able to do that, as it does try to find a way to fight this surge, because as the White House's doctors have said and the president's health advisors, that if Americans who are asymptomatic or might have mild symptoms of COVID-19 were able to test when they first started to have those symptoms or knew that they were in close contact with someone who had had COVID-19 several days later, that they could cut down on the spread by testing.
It's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national news. Francesca Chambers is with us, White House correspondent for McClatchy. We are looking right now at the White House response and the president's address yesterday on COVID and the Omicron variant. Coming up, we'll look at the Build Back Better legislation. Stalled, unsure future. Things look bad for it after Senator Joe Manchin says he won't vote for it. You could join in with your thoughts on either of those topics at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Another key part of the speech, it seems, Francesca, is the president saying, we're not talking about lockdowns, we're trying to keep schools open. What kind of things did he say there?
Right. He said that now students who have been in a classroom with someone else who ended up testing positive for COVID can test to return, essentially, that if they test negative, they can come back to the classroom. That way, schools don't have to shut down. And he had an important message on that, saying that schools should indeed remain open. So that's a very different place than the country was a year ago or even in March of 2020.
Do you get a sense that the president wants to be focusing on other things, legislative priorities, build back better, but keeps having to come back to COVID because COVID keeps coming back?
And it's even when he's talking about the supply chain issues, when he's talking about the student debt relief, even his student debt relief statement today ended with talking about the need for Americans to get vaccinated and to get boosted, because until the country moves on from the pandemic, it will be difficult, as he and his economic advisors have said, to address some of the other problems like inflation that the country is experiencing. Of course, the president also says that if his Build Back Better agenda were to pass, that would also help with inflation too. But it sounds like we're going to get to that in a little bit.
And often President Biden talks about his faith in Americans. He says to take on challenges when they come together. Did he have that kind of, patriotic call to action before we move on from this address from yesterday?
He did, and he said that getting vaccinated is also patriotic, and he called on Americans to really keep the faith at a time when, again, he noted that heading into the holidays, especially, that they may be frustrated that at the end of this year, it sometimes feels like things aren't as better as they would like them to be heading into the new year, but again, stressing that America has more tools to fight the pandemic than it did 18 months ago.
We're talking to Francesca Chambers, White House correspondent for McClatchy. It's the week in Washington. In just a minute, we'll look at what's next for the Build Back Better plan after Senator Joe Manchin said he won't support the president's agenda item. We'll have more on Omicron and COVID-19 coming up with an epidemiologist. Right now, you can weigh in on Build Back Better at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to Senator Joe Manchin, the key 50th vote, saying he is not a vote, at least not right now, on Build Back Better? Do you want to see the president and Senator Manchin get together, maybe come up with a new plan? Are you glad to see this plan not passing, at least not for now? There's a lot in it. Drug costs, climate change, child tax credits. Are there parts you want to see advanced on? Do you worry about the costs of the whole thing? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our look at the top stories in national politics. Francesca Chambers stays with us, White House correspondent for McClatchy. Up next, Build Back Better, not moving forward, at least not for now. And you can join in with your reactions to that, your hopes or fears for it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Francesca, Senator Joe Manchin, a key to passing this Build Back Better legislation, spoke on Sunday. What did we hear from him about why he's not ready to move forward on this?
Well, one reason that he's not ready to move forward on this is inflation, as we were talking about earlier in the hour. He also is concerned that Build Back Better will cost more than Democrats originally thought that it would. Why does he think that? Because some of the provisions in Build Back Better that they put in there to sunset within a few years, he believes that ultimately lawmakers will extend those out to a decade. And when you put in the total cost of how long those programs would cost over a decade, it turns out to be much more than Democrats originally said that the bill would cost. So now Manchin is saying that he would like Democrats to come to a conclusion on some of these programs that would be within the original scope, the $1.5 to $1.85 trillion that they originally landed on. But that means that they're going to have to pick and choose between a whole host of programs if they want to get it down to that price tag.
Now, on Sunday, I mean, it seemed like this might just be done. But what I keep hearing from people is, if I can quote a movie, so you're saying there's still a chance?
Yes, it's not over until it's over. And even after the White House released a blistering statement from the White House press secretary of negotiations with Manchin, and you heard top progressives on Capitol Hill saying that they essentially felt betrayed in this process, then you heard a little bit of softening from there with the White House saying that they were going to try and move forward, work very hard to get this done, that conversations on this would continue in the new year, and even progressives having some conversations with Manchin and asking him to state clearly what he would support and what he just can't get behind to see if they can find some common ground.
Let's go to our callers at 800-642-1234. Louie is with us in Oconto. Louie, hi.
Yes. One comment I have is that when you have such a low interest rate, now is the time to be borrowing some money, not when the interest rates are high. So things are not that high as far as interest rates. But my main point was with the window shortening on trying to do something about climate change, and it's just not the U.S., but also trying to set an example and lead, because the whole world has to come together with that. I think that is a bad precedent that we're setting that we can't be relied on.
Louis. Thanks for the call, Francesca. Part of the president's climate change agenda happened in the thing that did pass, that bipartisan-ish infrastructure bill. But there was more, right? Climate change-related material in Build Back Better. That's still not concluded yet, right?
Right. There are some clean energy initiatives in the bipartisan infrastructure law that is already passed and now the federal government is implementing. But as for the Build Back Better agenda, that's right. One of the key sticking points for Manchin is over those climate initiatives. And in the House passed bill, there's $550 billion for climate and clean energy initiatives and a lot of tax credits. But that is one of the difficulties here, including on credits for electric vehicles. And that's one of the things that they're going to have to work out if they're going to move forward on this, either as part of one large bill or as a part of smaller broken up bills.
Thanks for that call, Louie, at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Mike with us in Shorewood. Mike, hi.
Hey, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I don't have any problem with the price tag on the Build Back Better. And my comments really, if you look at the last two Republican administrations, they put us into serious debt. And really only the uber wealthy benefited from all that tax cut legislation they put together. So why can't we have some, a bill where we have more equitable debt, I guess I would call it. I don't have a problem of racking up trillions trying to save the environment and, giving people who need aid. And that's my comment. Thank you.
Mike, thanks for that call. And I've heard some comparisons to the price tag on the tax cuts passed, I think, in the first year of the Trump administration. Are we hearing Democrats make that kind of comparison, Francesca?
It was the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that you're referring to that passed with Republican support. And some Democrats are making that comparison. However, President Biden himself has said that he does not want to pass programs that aren't paid for. In fact, one of the White House's biggest pushes on this is that all of it is paid for. They say that it won't end up costing anything. So it would be a pretty big reversal from that language if they move forward in that capacity. This is something that the White House has reiterated recently as it talks about the expanded child tax credit, which is another key provision here. That is something where those expanded payments, those monthly payments that were going out every month, Americans saw the last of those last week. They are not expected to see those anymore unless the Build Back Better legislation passes. But the White House has said it can't foresee a situation in which even that would pass standalone or that the president would support that standalone unless Congress finds a way to pay for that.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Francesca Chambers from McClatchy, looking at some of the big stories in national politics, including Build Back Better. Still not done yet, but maybe not done for yet. Still time for your thoughts on that at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Back to your calls now. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Hello. Yeah, it seems to me that they had made a deal with the liberal part of the Democratic Party to pass this after they did the infrastructure. It looks like they're kind of going back on that. And I guess my other comment would be the Dems, they need to start playing hardball. So there's a big defense bill sitting on Biden's desk, $800 billion authorization. He should just say, if we don't get anything on the Build Back Better, maybe I won't sign this. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Jimmy, thanks for calling in. Francesca, the first point first, there was a long delay over, are we going to pass infrastructure and this one at the same time? Who goes first? What ended up happening? How did that shake out?
Well, the reason that infrastructure ended up passing the bipartisan law is because President Biden assured progressives that he could get 50 votes in the United States Senate, which is how many Democrats plus independents who caucus with the Democrats that there are, that he could get the votes for the Build Back Better legislation that includes more of the progressives' priorities. And so you heard progressive leaders in the House this week say that that is part of the reason. I mean, not the entire reason that they went forward with this before they got the vote that they wanted on Build Back Better. So that's where some of the tension is coming from. And you did hear Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez say that she wanted Democratic leaders. She felt that President Biden had made that pledge and that they needed to fulfill it.
And then the idea of sort of holding the National Defense Authorization Act, I guess, hostage to get this thing passed. Politically, I can't really imagine a president doing that. Can you?
Not something that I've specifically heard floated around the White House.
All right. Thanks again for calling in, Jimmy, at 800-642-1234. We heard Senator Manchin on a West Virginia radio interview on Sunday kind of point the finger at not President Biden, but White House staff. President Biden has talked about his personal relationship with Senator Manchin. Is that where this is going next, do you think? Biden, Manchin talking, you're not face-to-face, phone-to-phone?
Well, we might not know when that happens, because after the most recent incident, the White House says it's not going to disclose anymore when President Biden and Joe Manchin have those conversations. So we may know about them sometimes. Senator Manchin sometimes talks about them to reporters on Capitol Hill. But at the same time, we may not know if those conversations take place based on what the White House is saying now.
Well, absent that information, Francesca, before we move on from Build Back Better, what are you watching for next?
Well, when the Senate returns in session, Leader Schumer says that they will be having a vote on this legislation, that they will be having votes on voting rights legislation, and that if it doesn't pass, then they will move forward from that and they will continue voting until they get the president's agenda passed. This is at the request of Bernie Sanders and other Democrats who just wanted to see a vote on this. They wanted to see Senator Manchin have to explain on the floor why he's against certain provisions. And so now Democratic leader Schumer says that's what they're going to do when they come back.
On a lighter note, Francesca, a personnel shakeup in the West Wing when it comes to canine personnel and the pets there. What's going on?
Yes, out with the old and in with the new. President Biden is sending his pet Major, the dog, to go live with another family after a series of biting incidents that took place in behavioral training. The first family now says that Major will be moving in with family friends, and he has a new pup named Commander who's joining them at the White House. And in the new year, the White House says that they'll finally be getting that cat that they've been talking about for so long. We know it's a female, but we don't know what the name yet is of the White House cat.
And finally, Francesca, this will be the last time we talk to you in 2021. It's been a big year, lots of stories going on. What are some of the big themes, the big issues you're going to be watching for come 2022?
Well, I hate to start talking about the 2022 midterms when we're already in 2021. I'm sorry. But it is that it will be the big story nationally of the year. Who comes out on top in the Senate? What's that mean for the president's agenda? Do Democrats get more seats as they say that they need in order to pass more of his agenda? Or do we see Republicans take back control of the United States Senate again, which would essentially assure that none of the president's agenda gets done after those 2022 midterm elections? And of course, please don't hate me, we're all looking towards 2024 as well, but I'm sure we'll talk about that more another day.
And will your eyes be here on Wisconsin when it comes to a key Senate race that will be part of shaping that control?
Absolutely. In Wisconsin, that would be a key race that if it were to flip from Republican, it's currently held, of course, by Ron Johnson, to Democrat, that would alone give Democrats 51 votes in the United States Senate. And then Vice President Harris would no longer have to act as tiebreaker. So also a key race, one of the top in the country for sure.
Francesca, as always, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Have a happy holiday.
You too. Francesca Chambers is a White House correspondent at McClatchy. She was with us for a look at the week in Washington. Coming up after the news, we talk to an epidemiologist about what we know about Omicron and get some advice on staying safe over the holidays. You can get started with your questions right now if you'd like. Send an email, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. You can ask an epidemiologist about safety precautions, the new variant, the effectiveness of vaccines, and what's around the corner. We'll be talking about those issues and more. Again, email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. And remember, you can follow all these conversations live or archived at WPR.org or with the Wisconsin Public Radio app. And those are great ways to share great conversations you've heard along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.